Our last speaker today on cruise ship liability, and he'll also discuss forum selection and arbitration clauses, is Charles Lipkin. He's in Miami, Florida. He's graduated from the University of Miami School of Law. He's handled cruise ship line cases since 1971, handled the first class action in Admiralty, got the largest single verdict for a seaman at the time in the amount that I'm not allowed to tell you, but I'll tell you, it's a big number. He's one of the lead attorneys in the sinking of the largest drill ship in the world, the Ocean Ranger, off of Newfoundland, Canada. He's had numerous landmark decisions, including a seaman case involving a retaliatory discharge claim against a vessel owner by reason of being fired for refusing to lie under oath for the shipping company. A seafarer injured in a separate accident on land while getting maintenance and cure from the ship owner or employer was entitled to receive continued maintenance and cure for the separate accident. Two other interesting cases involving physicians that the state medical malpractice pre-suit procedures did not apply to a claim of medical negligence by a passenger against a doctor and nurse on a cruise line, and also that in a case where the cruise line was held liable to a passenger for the negligence of a ship's doctor, even though the doctor was an independent contractor. He publishes on the internet the Cruise Line Law Reporter, which I would urge you to look at if you haven't before. It reports on cases important to the cruise line litigation. He's very interestingly presently consulting on a proposed television pilot dealing with an admiralty law practice. He's appeared on numerous television shows with respect to admiralty matters, including Inside Edition, Geraldo at Large, Fox, CBS Early Show, Catherine Cryer, Court TV, O'Reilly, and others. Charles Lipkin.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. I know you're all tired, and I'm going to speed this up. I like this position when I have to talk. The only thing standing between you and your lunch is me, so I know you won't give me a hard time. My topic is the update on cruise ship liability and forum selection clauses / arbitration clauses. Jerry Dotson just did a wonderful job covering that entire topic, for which I'd like to thank him. But I'm going to deviate a little from my topic and perhaps add a little onto that. I'd like to thank ATLA and the Admiralty Section for inviting me to speak. And from your prior speakers, it's easy to see that this is a very high-level program. I got an email from G.J. Sullivan. Is he in the room, G.J. Sullivan? I don't know if any of you have seen this email, but it's just too good to not pass it on to you. This may or may not be true. In the 16th and 17th centuries, before commercial fertilizer, manure used to be shipped. And it was shipped in a dry form since it would weigh less. And when it was stored low in the ships, and these are wooden ships, it would get wet and produce methane gas. And when the watchman would go around and he would have his wicker lamp, and that wicker lamp met up with methane gas, boom, ship was gone. And after several of those ships were lost, it was finally figured out that the low storage of the manure was the cause of the problem. So thereafter, whenever manure was being stored, the plan was marked with the initials SHIT, ship high in transport. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But anyway, it is a little Admiralty anecdote. The last time I spoke at ATLA, I made reference to the fact that foreign seamen were the canary in the mine. The canary is not doing well. The oxygen supply for crew member cases is running out. Time is running out. More on that later, and hopefully that will be discussed at the roundtable. What I'd like to do is go right to my conclusion. So I'm doing this in a reverse order. And this will be the conclusion that you can derive from my topic today. And this will allow you to apply what you've learned today to your own practice and to immediately save a substantial amount of money. What could be better? Also, if you don't want to hear what leads up to my conclusion, you can go to lunch early. Conclusion: A, incorporate your law firm in a third world country which recognizes the enforcement of arbitration clauses. Not hard to do. Find one of those services the shipping companies use. You don't have to have an office there. You don't have to have employees there. You don't even ever have to go there at all. B, put an arbitration clause in your contract with your clients. Make sure that you use a country that no one can afford to travel to, that have the proceedings in a foreign language with very expensive translators, and use a country that doesn't allow for contingent fee contracts, and also requires that you pay a fee based on the amount claimed, as well as a deposit of the other side's legal fees if you lose. Now, I've looked that up. On a $100,000 claim in some places in Europe, you will have to come up with a deposit of about $20,000 to get the ball rolling. Now for the best part. This is where you save the money. Cancel your malpractice insurance. You'll never, ever see a claim. Now, if we as lawyers did that to our clients, we would be in a lot of trouble. But for some reason, the shipping companies, who are the guardians of the seamen's rights, can do this and more. Last part, list your company on one of the major stock exchanges. Pay yourself with backdated options so you have a reduced tax bracket. Now, can anyone explain the fairness or the rationale for any of this? I can't. And perhaps that's something that we need to address again at the round table. Anyway, that's my conclusion from what I've learned from studying arbitration clauses. Venue clauses in Siemens contracts have historically been ignored. See Hellenic Lines versus Rhodidus. That was a case of the Greek seaman against a Greek company. He got hurt on a Greek flag vessel. The contract required suit in Greece with use of Greek law. And because the owner lived in New York, that was deemed to be a base of operations, and that was good enough for the U.S. Jones Act and U.S. law to apply. Now, the history of the Arbitration Act is really at the core of all these problems. The Federal Arbitration Act is found at 9 U.S.C. 1. Section 1 excludes from the operation maritime transactions and identifies numerous types of agreements, such as charter parties and other things which should be included. The Act, and Mr. Dodson made reference to this, specifically excludes from its operation contracts of employment of seamen, railroad workers, or other class of workers engaged in foreign or interstate commerce. In 1958, the United Nations Commission on International Trade promulgated the Convention on the Recognition and Enforcement of Foreign Arbitral Awards. Article 2 of the Convention requires each state agreeing to the Convention to recognize agreements to arbitrate. The U.S. ratified this agreement in 1970 with the provision that it would apply only to differences arising out of legal relationships considered commercial under the national law. No definition was put into what was commercial because at the time, and once again Mr. Dodson alluded to what was discussed by Congress, at the time the testimony was that it was not necessary to really define what was commercial since it had already been done in Part 1. And Part 1 was the part that excluded railroad workers and seamen. Now, from the implementation in 1970 until 2002, there was never an issue as to the application of the convention to seamen's contracts. Then in a tortured opinion, the Fifth Circuit of Appeals, and that's the Stolt decision, held that the definition section of 9 U.S.C. 1 did not apply to the convention. Therefore, Siemens contracts were not excluded from the application of foreign arbitration provisions. Ambassador Kearney's remarks were meaningless, and 28 U.S.C. 1445A was trumped by the subsequently enacted provisions of 9 U.S.C. 205. Now, that's sort of the background to this whole arbitration issue. Now, I know in the Norway explosion case, Bautista, that the Arguelles decision was not argued. And I believe this is a very important decision. That's U.S. Bulk Carriers versus Arguelles. That says basically that you cannot take away statutory rights from a seaman. That was a wage claim case where the collective bargaining agreement for a U.S. seaman required that it be arbitrated. The U.S. Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to enforce the arbitration provision of the collective bargaining agreement because it would take away the seaman's statutory rights. Now, what you have in my paper, and I'm not going to go over that, is a case that my office brought in Miami, Lobo versus Celebrity Cruises. What we did in Lobo versus Celebrity Cruises followed Arguelles exactly. It's a case involving a statutory wage claim and nothing else. It's a case where there's a collective bargaining agreement that requires arbitration or may require arbitration. And the feeling was that this is exactly on point with Arguelles, and it's a good way to bring up to the 11th Circuit the question of whether Arguelles is still good law today. And the reason why that's important is because of the Jones Act. The Jones Act is also a statutory remedy. So if we can get the court to acknowledge Arguelles in the 11th Circuit, and this is step one, if we can get them to acknowledge that statutory remedies are protected, step two then will be the Jones Act. Or perhaps it will be a launching pad to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they can then tell us whether or not Arguelles is still good law today. As I said, unfortunately, this was not raised in the Norway explosion case. Nobody ever talked about Arguelles. And so it's something new that can be tried. Now, in looking at these arbitration clauses, and obviously that's probably the biggest problem we all face today or will be facing in our practice, if we have a practice, we've put together a group in Miami that is meeting weekly, and these are some of the ideas we've come up with. And I don't know if any of you read the book, The Wisdom of Crowds, but what it basically says is that groups make better decisions than individuals, even if the individuals are extremely smart. So we have group meetings every Friday, and anybody's welcome to join them directly or by telephone. And we are working on this particular issue. And what we feel is the proper response to arbitration clauses sort of goes like this. One, the Jones Act is a statutory remedy, and under Arguelles, seaman can't lose his rights under arbitration. Two, the seaman's contracts are not commercial, so that the Arbitration Act does not apply. Now, of course, that's been lost in the Fifth and 11th Circuit, but it would be nice if we could get that issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. Three, even if the court deemed the convention applies to seaman, the arbitration clause is unenforceable and or null and void, violating U.S. policy and principles of law. Now, under that section, what we've looked at is and once again, these are things that we believe have not been looked at before. The Ship Owners Liability Convention of 1936, that's another treaty, just like the arbitration treaty. And I think it's very compelling. I'm looking for a case to file where a seaman who comes under arbitration clause is in need of immediate medical care. And the Norway case would have been a good one to do it on, but it just wasn't done. So we can't go back. We have to go forward. But if you have a seaman who needs immediate medical care and he's laying there on the dock and he needs to get to the emergency room and the shipping company steps up and says to that seaman, oh, well, go to the Philippines, go to Indonesia, go to Monte Carlo and arbitrate your need for your immediate emergency medical care. Now, it seems to me arbitration clauses would be kind of harsh in that situation and that factually we would be in a better position. And not only factually, but the ship owner's liability, sick and injured seaman convention, would also apply. And that convention states under Article 9, national laws or regulations shall make provision for securing the rapid and inexpensive settlement of disputes concerning the liability of the ship owner under this convention. And that's for the maintenance and cure, or really for the cure. So there's nothing rapid or inexpensive about forcing a seaman who needs immediate medical care to go to a foreign country. So I would submit that perhaps this treaty is one way to open the door or get the dialogue going again in the court system. Secondly, if you're dealing with a foreign flag vessel, I mean, one way to get rid of arbitration clauses is to show that the contract's not valid. Now, if you're dealing with a foreign ship owner, there's another convention. That's the Seaman Articles of Agreement Convention of 1926. This convention was not signed by the United States, but was signed by many of the third world countries, flag of convenience countries. And if you're dealing with a foreign flag vessel that uses, that comes from a country that has signed onto this treaty, it's very, very good. And here's why. Under Article 3, it says, articles of agreement shall be signed both by the ship owner or his representative and by the seaman. Reasonable facilities to examine the articles of agreement before they are signed shall be given to the seaman and also to his advisor. So not only does the seaman get time to look at it, but he's got an advisor to help him look it over. Number two, the seaman shall sign the agreement under conditions which shall be prescribed by national law in order to ensure adequate supervision by the competent public authority. Three, the foregoing provisions shall be deemed to have been fulfilled if the competent authority certifies that the provisions of the agreement have been laid before it in writing and have been confirmed both by the ship owner or by his representative and by the seaman. Four, national law shall make adequate provision to ensure that the seaman has understood the agreement. None of these things are being done today. Let's talk about Carnival Cruise Lines. In every contract they have the seaman sign now. It's a take it or leave it. You know, sign it or you don't have a job, or sign it when you're getting on the ship. They don't get to look at it. They don't get to discuss it. They don't have an advisor. And the national law doesn't require that the provisions be fair. Now, since Carnival only uses foreign flag vessels, their vessels are flagged in countries that have signed off on this treaty. So I would submit to you, if you have a case like that, check out the law of the flag, see if they're one of the signatories to this treaty, and then knock out the contract, because none of these steps will have been followed. Now, I do think in looking at the POEA, it seems to me that perhaps this has sort of been followed by the Philippines, because they do have this whole POEA setup going on. And I have a POEA case now, and in looking at the contract that they produced, I noticed that at the bottom there's a line there that says approved by, and then there's a signature line for the POEA. Well, it wasn't signed. And since it wasn't signed, it's in violation of this treaty. I'm running that up the flagpole. I'll see what happens. I'm not too hopeful, though. Getting back to other things you can do to avoid arbitration agreements. If you look at the Sky Reefer case at 512 U.S. 528, they talk about if the arbitration clause creates a high hurdle to enforcement of your rights, then it's unconstitutional. Now, that was a cargo case where they made some people go to Japan or somewhere. But that high hurdle language is very good. It seems to me that with seamen, that all of these provisions that we're talking about are high hurdles and therefore would be unconstitutional. And in deciding whether or not it's a high hurdle, you need to look at the costs. And I think you need to not just say it. You can't just come into court and say, well, it's too expensive. I think you really need to look at what it's going to cost to go to Monte Carlo or wherever the arbitration clause says you have to go, and present evidence of that to the court. In addition, you should present evidence of the financial wherewithal of your client. Now, we just did an affidavit in the case, and my client had about $50 to his name, and he owned an 8-year-old Sony TV. And that was all of the assets this man had after a lifetime of work as a seaman. Now, how can that man go to Monte Carlo or wherever else the company is designated? I mean, it's just a fiction. But I think in order to get somewhere with the courts today, I think you really have to document all of that and drive the point home and not just say it. You've got to prove it. And perhaps along those lines, even use an expert to come in, maybe someone such as Mr. Dotson, who has a lot of experience, to come in and just say, this is totally impossible for a seaman to do. What will happen? I don't know. It's a work in progress. And then you have other things, unequal bargaining power and all of that stuff you can raise also. That's the seaman side of the update. And it's not too promising, but hopefully at our next meeting, some light will come shining through the clouds. Just briefly, on the passenger side, whenever I talk to attorneys, I try to emphasize to them, if you get a passenger claim on one of these cruise ships that sail out of Miami, first thing you do is look at the ticket. Look at it every single time, because once every 5 or 10 years, they change those tickets. Don't assume the ticket is the same as the one before, or you could wind up filing in the wrong court. But the passenger ticket, which is binding, will tell you that normally you've got 6 months to put the company on notice. If someone's seriously injured, going to the doctor can be considered notice, but I wouldn't take a chance. I would just get that written notice in. You have 1 year to file suit. And that's pretty much across the board, unless you're dealing with a minor or an incompetent, and then there's a whole different time scheme that may give you up to 3 years or longer. Then the ticket will have a venue provision, and typically, here in Seattle, if you've got Holland America Lines, you need to file suit in Seattle. If you've got Carnival, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise Lines, Silver Seas, and just about every other company, you need to be suing in South Florida. And if you've got P&O, Princess Cruises, their ticket is L.A. So by all means, read those tickets and don't make any assumptions. And the last update I have for you is from the passenger side is the Carlisle case. Carlisle was a case where a young girl went to the doctor on board the ship. He never even examined her. She was having stomach pains. She's vomiting. Doctor said, you got the flu. Gave her some aspirin. She came back the next day. Doctor never examined her again. He said, you still got the flu. Gave her some more aspirins. The parents called their doctor back home in Michigan or Minnesota. The doctor said, get off that ship immediately. You need to go see a doctor. Turned out she had a ruptured appendix, and because of the delay, she's now sterile. the rupture caused a lot of infection, which healed with scarring, and it's very painful for her. And the cruise lines, of course, came in and said, well, we're not responsible for bad medical care, you know, once we have a qualified doctor. The Third District Court of Appeals in Florida said, oh, no, you are responsible for bad medical care. You know, the doctor wears your uniform, you advertise him, you got a clinic, it's in your literature, he's your apparent agent, and we're making you responsible. And this is a very important case because there are a lot of people on cruise ships getting a lot of bad medical care. And there's no incentive for the cruise lines, well, there hasn't been an incentive for them to do a better job unless they're responsible. We all know how that works. Well, anyway, we just argued that in the Florida Supreme Court in October. It went very well, I thought, for our side, but we're still waiting on the decision. And if you talk to someone who got bad medical care on a ship, and normally I would say if I file 100 suits, 90 of them have account for bad medical care. That's just how rampant it is, especially with crew members. So keep your eyes peeled for that particular case. When it does come out, it will be in a Cruise Line Law Reporter, which we put out, and you can look at that at www.lipcon.com, and you can also request that you be put on the mailing list, and we try to do that monthly. I think I'm finishing right on time. I brought the program.
Paul? Yeah, I just wanted to say something. You may be faced with the Athens Convention, which can apply on tickets outside the United States. It has a limitation of close to $70,000, which we hope will be changed by a new international agreement that will give you a much better deal. But you would have 2 years to sue, so you have to really realize from the ticket whether the Athens Convention will apply, because if they don't put the proper language in the ticket, and this is a Ninth Circuit case, so now I guess all the tickets have proper language, that if it doesn't really advise the passenger that the Athens Convention applies, but in fact it does, you now have a 2-year statute limitation, but no limitation to damages.
Okay, I think, and those are on ships that don't touch a U.S. port. Yeah, what happens is you need to look at those very carefully. If you're dealing with someone who went over to Europe and took a cruise, you know, around the Mediterranean or up the Baltic,
or even around the Caribbean,
if they don't touch the U.S., they may choose a forum that could be Genoa or London or some other place, and that may or may not be enforceable. I submitted a bill years ago. I tried to get them to add in the same language for ships that touch the U.S. would also apply to these packages, where people buy packages that include their airfare and the cruise. They pay the cruise line for it. And I said, well, gee, if they're starting even on an airplane in the U.S., why shouldn't that law apply to them, you know, where they can't have those kind of limitations? So that's another area where you have to be very, very careful. Yep. Yes, sir, back there.
Hi. I have a similar situation. Company out of Massachusetts called Grand Circle Tours that advertises for river cruises in Europe. They put themselves out of owning their own vessels, yet they have a forum selection clause in their contracts, in their passenger tickets, that specifies United Kingdom somewhere. How can that possibly be enforceable even under SHUT, where you have a company that is based in the U.S. who says, we own our own vessels,
Yes, I had a claim against the same company, and it turns out everything goes through some Swiss operation. The owner's really Swiss, and you know, I think you just need to get in there and, you know, and make the claim that if they're advertising that they're the owners, that they are the owners. They're at least the apparent agent of the owners,
and
We settled as that was going on, and it was not what I'd call a major settlement. It was a, it wasn't a home run, it was a single. But in those situations, sometimes a single is better than anything else, so especially with what's going on these days. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Chuck, if the cruise lines are successful with their move into arbitration with employment contracts, you foresee the time when they're going to plug into the passenger ticket contract that you're accepting arbitration perhaps outside the United States?
You know, I've been thinking about that, but there is a statute that limits what the cruise lines can do in terms of the passenger ticket. And that statute says they can't have a shorter time period than 1 year to sue, that things like that. And you need to look at that statute and see how it plays out. But I would guess, you know, they'll move along in that direction. I mean, they're very, very smart. They know exactly what they're doing. And I think as Paul pointed out before, they start nipping at you, and then, you know, they take a small bite. And then they move right along, trying to figure out how to avoid paying anybody at any time.
Well, if you believe that you should look at that statute, I think we believe we should have looked at the statute that applies to the foreign seaman and these arbitration situations too. Because if you read that statute, you wouldn't think that it would apply.
Exactly.
You know, so I'm not sure how far that
goes. Yeah. Well, I think one thing you got to look at if. Now, somebody told me this. I'm sure Jack Hickey knows the answer. Jack was supposed to come up here and spend 10 minutes, but I haven't heard from him this time. But I heard some. Okay, just give me one more minute, Jack. I heard somewhere that I don't know, less than 1% of all civil cases in federal court actually go to trial. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know from my personal experience that we basically don't have trials. Everything's decided on you're dismissed on a motion to dismiss, or you lose on summary judgment. It just, you never seem to get to a trial. And I'm kind of curious about that. Does anybody know the statistics? Yes?
I don't know the statistics, but I was with federal judge in Eastern District of Virginia about a month ago. And he said that last year in the Eastern District of Virginia, judges still there. And this is where the whole hobbies, I mean, there's a lot of criminal and civil litigation funneled through Eastern District. 6 jury trials in 05.
For all 5 judges?
A total in that building. 6. Every year. 6 for 05.
Civil or 6?
Both.
Civil and criminal?
Total.
For how long?
Total.
For a year.
Yep, for a year.
Well, to me, that's kind of telling because if
they spent $150 million on a new courthouse, but I guess what they need.
They don't need another judge, too.
Right.
Yeah, or more than one. But, you know, if the system is geared up to really not want to handle cases, even though that's their job, then they got to get rid of them somehow. Arbitration clauses sure are a nice, neat way to do it. But I don't know what the motivation is there. Any other questions? Okay, Jack, it's all yours.
Roundtable discussion's open, so okay. We'll try and run through the business meeting stuff as quickly as we can, and then we'll go to the roundtable.
I'll give you all that. Let me just thank all of you for attending. If you have, and I've got a few more announcements, but if you haven't signed in, please sign in, and remember to fill out your CLE to get your CLE. There should be a certificate of not documentation or inspection, but a certificate of attendance and a TAN worksheet in your materials, probably that you picked up yesterday, that you need to fill out. If you're from Kentucky, I think Ohio and Louisiana, you need to fill out a scan card too. I think there's a box up where we registered where you turn that in. If not, ask one of these folks out here wearing a ATLA tag to help you. I'd like to thank Mitch, Jerry, Reggie, and Chuck for agreeing to come to Seattle and to provide their presentations. I'd also like to thank Scott for leading this section over the past year. We have faced many challenges, some of which Paul has talked about, some of which the speakers have talked about. I expect that we will face many more challenges over the next year. You know, our clients and rights and our livelihoods and practices seem to have been under attack for I haven't been practicing as long as many of you in here, but it seems as long as I've been practicing, our clients' rights and our livelihoods and practices have been attacked, eroded, and under siege, and I expect that to continue into the foreseeable future, at least until such time as we have a different makeup of those that make the rules. And unfortunately, that has not been a situation that has helped us, where as plaintiff's attorneys, we're used to going on the offensive. We seem to have been on the defensive for quite a few years now, and I'm afraid that is likely to continue. As far as the schedule is concerned, we have the business meeting from 1 to 2 p.m., which we welcome you all to attend. At that, we're likely to talk about increasing our membership and our numbers and anything.
Publication of cases
and ANC and so forth. But we will roll right into and through that into the roundtable discussion where we'll talk about some of the things that Paul Hoffman talked about, the wage penalty statutes, the FELA case that has bearing on our practice, and that will go until 3:30. So the business meeting will start at 1. We'll roll until 3:30 with the roundtable discussion, and then I don't know what is on the schedule from 3:30 to 4:30. Maybe we'll continue the roundtable, but there is a reception from 4:30 to 5:30, and the business meeting and the roundtable discussion are in room 204. The reception is room 601. So room 204 and 601. Again, thanks to the speakers, thanks to Scott, and thanks to all of you. Yes, sir.
Thank you.